I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. The Philadelphia region is seeing an alarming increase in prescription drug addiction, overdose, even death, especially among teenagers who believe these pharmaceuticals are harmless. Painkillers are readily available at parties, on school campuses, even parking lots. Law enforcement has been cracking down on the sale of these opioids, which has made the pills more expensive and more risky to use. Some teenagers have turned to heroin as a less expensive alternative to oxycodone or Vicodin or Percocet. Heroin in this area is known for its cheapness and its purity. Local counties are reporting an increase in heroin-related deaths. So why have these drugs become so popular among the youth, and what can be done to control their availability and abuse? We have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. David Fialco, a prevention specialist at the Council of Southeast Pennsylvania. That's a private nonprofit organization founded back in 1975 to provide prevention, intervention, and addiction recovery services and programs. And David, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Jeremiah Daly, Executive Director of the Philadelphia Camden High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area Program, a bit of a mouthful, coordinates drug enforcement efforts in Philadelphia, Delaware, and Chester counties in Pennsylvania and Camden County in New Jersey. And Jerry, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning, Marty. Thanks for having us.
You're very welcome. I'd like to begin with prescription drug abuse and start there, and then we'll work our way towards this problem of heroin addiction or heroin abuse. Is this a new phenomenon, Jerry, this idea that especially teenagers having access to prescription drugs?
Probably only about a generation old. We've seen some changes in thinking amongst the medical community on how to treat pain and injuries that cause pain, and we're seeing more and more prescriptions being written for young people, for particularly sports-related injuries and automobile accidents and things like that, where they in the generations prior, you would not get that kind of an option. So we are seeing more of the prescription opioids and opiate drugs being prescribed for young people, and as a consequence, a percentage of those go on to abuse them for non-therapeutic purposes.
And I'm assuming, David, some teenagers are looking in their parents' medicine cabinet and seeing these prescription drugs as well.
Absolutely. When you look at, when we screen and when we survey youth, whether it be through things like, Pennsylvania Youth Survey or other things that are out there, they report that the number one place they get their drugs from are from family members, relatives, or friends, and that means through the medicine cabinet, through diverted prescriptions. Maybe a friend has a back, broke a leg and they got a prescription. They may not take those drugs, but they'll sell them the diverted purpose.
Well, and I think anyone that watches TV, I mean, there's a lot of advertising when it comes to the prescription drugs that we're talking about. How much, David, do you think that also just sort of feeds the view of these drugs?
Well, I think that Jerry pointed out this is really, a generational issue, and this is the first generation that we're seeing it in this kind of broad coverage. And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that nothing against the pharmaceutical industry. We benefit greatly from pharmaceutical, organizations. But since 1997, we've seen direct marketing by the pharmaceutical industries direct to consumers. So, the first year we saw exponential, I think they recorded somewhere around a 300% increase in profits in 1998, a year after the first prescription commercial aired. So we're seeing things that, an entire generation now, if you're 18, you've grown up with these commercials that say, feeling depressed, feeling anxious, momentary, lapse of depression, having a hard time waking up, falling asleep. I think most people experience that. We have mortgages, multiple car payments, children. Life is stressful. So we're diagnosing ourselves now. And, realistically, the only person who should diagnose you is a doctor. But, I think that direct marketing has a big influence.
I mean, are we awash in these drugs?
Clearly. The statistics show that America uses far more in the way of prescription opiates than any other country in the world. Even on a per capita basis, it's a factor of like 10 times as much. We write so many scripts and have so many pills dispensed that it's just an enormous industry. And again, I mean, I think it's got to be said, some of the developments by the pharmaceutical industry have been just fantastic breakthroughs for those in severe chronic pain. We're not, you know, casting aspersions at them for the research and development. I think where the shortfall has been is in monitoring and controlling the amount of prescriptions being prescribed to any individual over a period of time and seeing if there's alternative course of action that might be taken that would be less likely to create a person becoming dependent.
Absolutely. And if you don't for example, you know, in 2009, there was approximately 257 million scripts written in doctor office visits. You know, that's, you know, I think the last time I checked, you know, the U.S. population was about 316 or 317 million people. You know, it's almost a prescription a person in the U.S. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we have become this very, prescription-heavy society where, yeah. If we broke a leg, and, you know, I'm a product of the 70s and 80s. If you broke a leg, you got aspirin or Tylenol, you know.
Yeah. Now it's a different scene, but help us understand, David. I guess the kind of buying and selling. If we're talking about suburban youth, and that's in part what we're focusing on, and, mm-hmm. and the sale and use of some of these prescription drugs, how does that work? I mean, are we seeing parties? Are we seeing parking lot deals? What's going on?
You'd be surprised on how prevalent that is. You know, if you're a 15, 16-year-old youth with a cell phone, you know, I often screen the kids that I work with. How long would it take for you to get a Perc or an Oxy or a Vicodin or even a benzodiazepine such as a Xanax? You know, they're like, 10 minutes. You know, they text
just
a friend
make
and,
a phone call.
You know, text. Actually, texting is a preferred method from what I hear. And you meet the person 10 minutes later, and it's usually about $1 per milligram. At least I think that's Philadelphia cost.
Roughly,
I know Bucks
yeah.
County
mm-hmm.
is, you know, you probably double that because of, mm-hmm. you know, the inflation and cost of transportation and all those. But, so it's access is a huge, huge issue.
And do we know how much this is going on? Is there any way to know that? Because obviously some of it is under the radar.
One in four youth have reported abusing and experimenting with prescription medication in the last 30 days. So one in four.
25%.
That's huge.
That is huge.
It is. It's an enormous number of people initiating recreational drug use. Mm-hmm. And the only explanation for it is the availability of it in their own homes. And as David was saying, you know, before, these are not people that generally start by going to find a dealer. They have a friend who has a friend, or they have a grandparent that might have it in the medicine cabinet or something like that. They're just getting it, you know, the availability of it. And the whole process of initiation of drug use, that's probably more in David's line, but there are a great number of kids who just feel compelled that they have to do these things to be part of the crowd, part of the cool kids, you know.
And when you
do parents know? If let's say it is a parent's prescription, it's in the medicine cabinet, it's left over from some kind of condition,
some oral surgery or something.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, are parents aware? Perhaps I'll put that to you, David. Are parents aware that perhaps their child is rifling through the medicine cabinet?
No, I don't think that. The majority are aware of the full potential of what's in a medicine cabinet, and that's why we do programs such as, you know, the prescription take back efforts, which is tomorrow across Bucks County and other counties. It's a national effort, you know, spearheaded by the DEA. You can go to DEA.gov and find us drop off site where you can drop off unused medications. Mm-hmm. But I don't think families really fully understand the potential that these, you know, in their minds, benign substances hold. We don't, you know, realistically get enough warning from the doctors or the prescribing agencies that give them, you know, we get a little folded up piece of paper that if you read the side effects and the warnings are very scary. Mm-hmm. That's why we do what we do, is to raise education, awareness on this topic and make sure that, you know, these pills are not being diverted or going to non-intended use.
Sure.
And I think that also, you know, when you asked their child, and it's not always their child. Sometimes their child is a very well put together young person, but they might have a friend who may not be the same come over, and all of a sudden somebody else is rifling. And I bet Jerry probably has something to say about home invasions and break-ins, what are being targeted.
Well, I was going to ask you about that.
Overall, I mean, other sources of supply beyond just, you know, the home medicine cabinet, Greater Philadelphia community, as well as other parts of the nation as well, have seen a grave increase in the number of robberies and burglaries of pharmacies and dispensaries of other sorts, whether it's a physician's office or at a other medical facility of some sort. People are targeting these businesses for the controlled substances that are in there because there is such a high resale value on the street. And it's a problem that's fueling the drug issue. It's also fueling the violence issue. It's also fueling the general crime issue, the property crime issue.
What's the sensation? What's the feeling someone gets, David, if they're using or, let's say, abusing these prescription drugs, oxycodone or something like that?
The solicitor responds, you know, when a person abuses these drugs or even uses them, even if you've been in a horrendous car accident or, you know, whatever surgery and you take these drugs, you're going to get a positive response from
them. These are painkillers, right?
These are painkillers. They do their jobs very effectively, and they also solicit a euphoric sensation. You know, they affect the way our brain works and as far as pleasure. And when you abuse these things, then that effect is even greater. And so, you know, like I said, the direct marketing, the kids have grown up saying, if you feel this way, take this pill. And, you know, we're seeing coping mechanisms, kind of, you know, healthy coping mechanisms being replaced with medication. And so they're going to have a good response to it. They're going to enjoy it. And that sets them up for, using it again. And then also when you look at the, how it's viewed, you know, the stigma associated with these. If a youth who is a, you know, football star, a cheerleader is offered a marijuana cigarette, a bottle of vodka or a beer or a pill, which are they going to choose?
And that's very important.
And you're saying they're going to choose the pill.
Yeah, because they see it as something that's legal. You know,
it's
it's medicine.
It's medicine. It's going to make you feel better. And that's, I think, you know, some of the attitudinal changes that have occurred as a result of the direct-to-consumer marketing of all drugs, not just, you know, opiates. In fact, you really don't see that many advertisements at all for painkillers. But just in general, the constant barrage of advertising for prescription drugs of any sort of kind of has a long-term erosive effect on the young person's disaffection for taking those kind of things. And I completely agree, you know, that very few of these kids start out using heroin. I mean, that's usually not the pathway. There is something before that, and oftentimes it is the prescription opiates.
Well, I want to pick up on that because we are talking about prescription opiates and heroin in this hour of Radio Times. That's Jerry Daly, and he's the executive director of the Philadelphia Camden High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area Program. Also with us, David Fialco, prevention specialist at the Council of Southeast Pennsylvania. We are talking about an increase in prescription drug addiction, even overdoses, sometimes fatal overdoses, and also its connection to heroin. Stay with us. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY is provided by Interact Theater Company, and we are proud to present. Called Incendiary by the New York Times, this dark comedy follows an ensemble of actors seeking to recreate a horrific event. Hidden hatred and dormant violence appear in We Are Proud to Present, which runs now to November 10th. Tickets available by phone at 215-568-8079 or online at interacttheater.org.
I'm Marty Moss Cohen. You turn to WHYY and Radio Times because you want to get beyond the sound bites, the shouting, and the uninformed opinions. We do your homework for you. We find smart, engaging, and informed guests, and we take the time to go deep on a wide range of issues. We're in the final stretch of the membership campaign, and our goal for this hour of Radio Times is 60 calls of support. How about $10 a month or $20 a month? You decide, and then you give us a call. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499, and you can pledge online at whyy.org. If you hear some urgency in my voice, it's because because we have a big overall goal for today if we want to end the drive on time. We've done it before. We can do it again. But that means if you haven't made a pledge of support, you need to do it right now. You know what you're paying for. You rely on the news and information that keeps you informed and entertained. 1-888-345-9499. Thanks. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're exploring how and why prescription opioid use and heroin abuse has become so prevalent here, certainly here in the Delaware Valley, what's being done to control its use and availability. And again, our guests are David Fialco and Jerry Daly. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Jerry, I was reading about Philadelphia, this region, an area known for cheap heroin and pure heroin. How come?
Well, it's been a long-standing problem in the region. It's been a formidable threat for many years to the greater Philadelphia region. We are situated, of course, in the Mid-Atlantic region. We're 90 miles from New York City, which is probably where the majority of heroin still comes from in our region. That which does not
down come 95,
down
mean?
95 or down Amtrak or down the mega bus, whatever, you know, is running, that will get people, you know, back and forth, somewhat inconspicuously, as a carrier. In addition to that, there's been a pretty, heavy demand in the region for a long time. We've had heroin issues going back 40, 50, 60 years in Philadelphia with a core, addict population in the city, but more recently it's been this expansion to non-traditional heroin communities, I guess, that has really highlighted the problem here. And that goes back to the, as you started off with, the relatively inexpensive nature of the heroin here and the high purity of the heroin at this level.
And what does that mean to be pure? And then I'll get you in and back into the conversation, David. And when we talk about pure heroin, what does that mean?
Well, as a percentage of the overall content of the packet that the heroin comes in, Philadelphia's heroin tends to be in the upper 50s, low 60s, which is extraordinarily high at the retail level, the street level. Even going back when I first started in police work 30-some years ago, purity levels were 10, 15, 20%. So you can see how much it has expanded. And there's a number of factors that have bearing on that, not the least of it, which was in the late 1980s, early 1990s, the Colombian drug lords that were so notorious for cocaine started dabbling in heroin. They realized they could grow poppy in the same Andean regions that coca leaves grow, coca plants grow, and they've, you know, become good at refining it. They've become very experts at refining the opium into heroin at a high purity level. And because it doesn't go through as many distribution channels each step along the way, typically somebody cuts the heroin to some extent with some adulterant, we're getting pretty high-level purity in this region.
You know, David, I'm trying to imagine, let's say, a teenage kid who is using Percocet or Vicodin, and we know that if we're talking about cheap, available heroin, that process of going from a prescription drug to something like heroin, it seems like such a huge leap to make that change.
It is, but in the scheme of things, you know, when I worked in counseling and as a clinician, the youth that were coming in front of my desk, and I worked in both intensive outpatient treatment facilities as well as a methadone facility, which is an opioid, you know, MMT, methadone maintenance treatment. The kids, and I call them kids because you have to be 18 to be in a methadone, but range from 18 to mid-20s. And they all come from very broad socioeconomic backgrounds, different incomes, different interests. You know, some were football players, some were, you know, the non-football player. I mean, everybody was different. But when they're self-reporting on their past history, it started to ring similar right the first time they started experimenting with prescription pills. And that progression goes very fast. And They experiment with it on a Friday because they don't want to use an illegal substance such as marijuana or alcohol or cocaine because that'll get them in trouble.
Right.
And they have a good experience. So the next Friday night or Saturday night, they do it again, and then it turns into Friday and Saturday night. And then, you know, Sunday as well. And somewhere in the middle of the week, maybe Wednesday, they start to feel a little ill. And, you know, they'll start, oh, man, I think I'm getting the flu. And they'll talk to their friend. They're like, you know what? Here, just take this. It'll make you feel better. And they take that. And that's where they make the connection. When I feel this way, I take this. And that's where the, you know, you have multiple levels of how addiction arises. And you have experimentation, use, abuse, dependency, and addiction. The experimentation and use is very subtle and very, you know, unaware, you know, the kids are unaware of it. But once they
– And they're teenagers too, so they think they're impervious.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So when they do get to that point where they're saying, I take this when I feel this way, the tolerance builds very fast inside of a couple weeks, a month. And so then, you know, what starts as a $5 or $10 a day habit an abuse, and it turns into a dependency where they have to have it. If they don't have it, they experience physical withdrawals, which are very discomforting,
sure,
very unpleasant.
Sure.
And that's one of the driving, motivating facts to seek the substance out. It's about $1 a milligram and, you know, $2 a milligram depending where you're at. And so, you know, a 10 milligram pill is $10 a day. But once your tolerance builds, that rises very rapidly up to, you know, $50, $60, $70, $80 a day.
And is that where the cheap heroin comes in?
Yeah,
in a sense, it's just more affordable than Vicodin or Percocet?
Well, sure. You know, what happens is, you know, the council, our agency, is located in Doylestown. Very, you know, it's an
sure
affluent community. And what we see are, you know, kids with disposable income. But once they exhaust that, you know, disposable income, they have to come up with alternative ways to acquire the money. And that leads to the, you know, where Jerry's, you know, passes a police officer come into play, and the run-ins with the law, and they burn bridges. And so they have to find an alternative way. And that's when somebody introduces them to the $10 a day solution, which is, a bag of heroin, which is about a tenth of a gram. And that keeps them good for all day until their tolerance builds.
And then they need two bags and four bags and 10 bags a day.
And let me ask you, Jerry, so are we talking then, if we're talking about suburban kids coming into Philly or perhaps North Philly or Camden?
Yes, absolutely. We see it regularly that people from outside the Philadelphia proper are coming in to purchase drugs for themselves. And often as not, they may be buying sufficient quantities to resell to others in their communities in the suburbs or the exurbs around Philadelphia and driving back, because there is such a great price variance between what's here in the city and what you can get in places like Doylestown or Hazleton or Williamsport or wherever upstate. So that's helps sustain that dependency as well, that they can satisfy their own drug needs by becoming low-level drug dealers.
I think many of us, myself included, have this image of a heroin user or perhaps even a heroin addict, perhaps in Philly in a, you know, abandoned building somewhere, kind of nodding out. Is that what we're talking about here?
It's quite true and maybe somewhat politically incorrect, but I think, you know, for a great number of us, we view a heroin addict as being a person of color, a person in their 20s or 30s or 40s, a person who's unemployed, a person who does not have the means to keep themselves in a home or any kind of residential setting, that they're out on the streets constantly and that they are breaking into cars and committing the quality of life crimes that drive city residents so crazy. That's not the case anymore. Today, we're looking, you know, at as many as not, if not more, who are white, who are in their early 20s, who are fairly well educated, who have jobs, and who, you know, are functional to the extent that, you know, they live at home with mom and dad, or they have their own apartment or something like that, at least for the time being. But that is only a short-term proposition for them. Eventually, they are going to go over the edge, and eventually they are going to start stealing from their family, stealing from their friends, stealing from neighbors, and engaging in other crimes as well, and losing all the comforts of home.
Because we're talking about heroin here.
Because we're talking about heroin.
Go ahead, Dave, and then I do want to get to our callers. Yeah.
And then, and you know, that movement from, you know, the pills to the heroin, you know, it, a lot of the kids don't even really recognize it as being heroin. When you talk to some of the kids, you know, they're like, well, you know, it was sold to me as smooth or you know, surnames. You know, so, you know, but that when they move to the heroin, they encephalate or snort it, and that keeps them, the cost down, and them good for the day or to avoid the negative withdrawals.
They could go to work, for instance?
Oh, absolutely. Functional, you know, if they haven't already burned the bridges with the seeking of the pill cost. But usually that's where the heroin comes in, is to avoid that behavior.
Right.
But once the tolerance builds up to that, they're back up to the $100 a day habit, and that's where the IV drug use then comes in. They talk to the, you know, the same people, you know, I can't afford this anymore. You know, what do I do? Oh, well, are you still snorting it? And that's when they say, well, I'm not a, quote, junkie. I'm not going to stick a needle in my arm and, you know, well, it's your money. You can waste it if you want. And it's just realistically a matter of time until that person moves from that, you know, that form of ingesting heroin to the IV. And once a person injects and goes IV with heroin, they don't necessarily go back to any other form because it is such a powerful way to utilize the substance. That's where the quality of life rapidly decreases and they end up, you know, burning the bridges and, you know, alienating friends, family, finding themselves, fitting that stereotype of that the person living on the avenue in an abandoned minium, you know, ripping copper and wire out of abandoned buildings and things like that. But it doesn't start there. These are people who look very – you know, they're good people. I don't want this to sound like, you know, they're bad. They're good people with, unfortunately, who haven't had the education on the potential for harm for this, and they're making very bad, unhealthy decisions, which, you know, change your lives forever.
Dave, and that's David Fialco, again, a prevention specialist at the Council of Southeast Pennsylvania. Also with us, Jerry Daly, executive director of the Philadelphia Camden High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area Program. We got a whole bunch of callers here at 1-888-477-9499. Let me see what Kim from Westchester has to say. And Kim, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I work with the kids your guest just described, suburbs, affluent families, pretty high functioning, but I totally agree they're on their way to, you know, losing their jobs, and usually they're in trouble with the law. And the thing they tell me is how strong the craving for heroin is once they get to that point, and, you know, more than other drugs they've used. So partly what I'm bringing this up for, because I really agree with most everything your guests have said, but it's making me really lean toward legalizing, you know, medical marijuana, because I feel that, you know, if a kid's in a car accident, you know, and you give them Percocet, especially if they've got the genetic vulnerability, you know, and they're high risk already, or maybe they're already experimenting, you know, it's kind of like you're feeding their addiction. And I feel like I don't know how much history they do in the hospitals with these kids when they've been in an accident, let's say, but, you know, to just start dishing out Percocet, I feel is almost irresponsible without knowing their history. And, you know, we're not seeing yet any evidence that medical marijuana has these, you know, real addictive kind of and damaging, you know, property. So,
well,
I,
you know, Kim, yeah, let me take your point and just give our guests a chance to weigh in on that. And I mean, obviously, we're not talking about all children or all kids or even young adults who are abusing prescription drugs. But do you think the thought of medical marijuana, Jerry, would in any way mitigate what we've been talking about?
I doubt it very seriously, simply because, by and large, the medical community as a whole is still somewhat, you know, skeptical of the therapeutic properties of marijuana, especially for something like pain. Where it is being employed and where it has been embraced, it's typically more for anxiety or for restoring appetite in someone who's had chemotherapy or is suffering from HIV complications. It's not really a good pain medication, at least as I understand it to be. I think it would be very, very much a leap to think that the medical community would go in that direction. Notwithstanding that, you know, the caller's point was very good in the sense that we really have to rethink what we're doing in terms of prescribing opiate drugs in quantities for pain that may be only temporary and acute in nature.
Well, and just reading the headline in the New York Times today, the Food and Drug Administration on Thursday, yesterday, recommended tighter controls on how doctors prescribe the most commonly used narcotic painkillers, which is, David, really what we're talking about here, and perhaps controlling it more at that end, at the front end.
Yes. Banning generic versions of OxyContin and, putting forth, tamper-resistant versions of the original OxyContin. But that is one of the reasons why, we're seeing the movement from the pills to the heroin is because of the costs and the difficulty to utilize or abuse these substances in such forms as IV drug use. Yes, you can still take the pill orally, but it's going to be time release. And if you tamper with it, you're going to – there's things in it as antagonists which basically force you into an automatic withdrawal, which is very, very unpleasant. So youth are going towards moving towards the heroin for some of these reasons. As is regarding the marijuana for, use of pain medication, I'm in my 40s. I grew up in a time where if you broke a leg, you got bare, you got, an NSAID, and, you deal with pain and you learn, to be more careful next time. Very, very few, I think, incidents require such a heavy duty, pain reduction medication such as, opioids or opiates. I think when you're talking about youth, you're looking at the developing brain, which is, the critical period between 12 and as late as 25. The brain is developing and it's forming all of the coping mechanisms of how a youth, will cope with pain, anxiety, stress, social situations, etc., by neural pruning. And if you inject any drug use, any substance use, even the medicinal marijuana, you're going to change the way that brain functions, and come the formation of the adult brain in the early 20s, that's what that person is going to turn to in order to cope with anxiety, pain, etc. So I think that for the normal, tooth pulling, dental visit, breaking a leg. Take an NSAID, and that should be what we're looking at, getting back to basics.
Well, and I wonder, again, we're about a minute away from our second break here, but I wonder, Jerry, so are we seeing, or is perhaps even law enforcement or the mental health community seeing an increase in the number of heroin users? We're talking about these prescription drugs as a kind of gateway or pathway, but is that what we're witnessing?
Yeah, quite clearly we're seeing an increase in the initiation of heroin use around the country, and particularly in that 20 to 25 age group range. The youngsters in middle schools to high school year tend to be more on the prescription drug diversion, but once they get into their 20s, they're experimenting with heroin. I think the data from the last Monitoring the Future study was pretty clear on that. We saw a twofold increase in the number of young people initiating heroin use for the first-time users. And then in terms of chronic users, one that they define as using it within the past 30 days, that was up almost threefold.
Uh-huh. Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. And that's Jeremiah Daly, Jerry Daly. Also with us, David Fialco. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Roadside Attractions, All is Lost, an adventure film from J.C. Shander, Academy Award-nominated writer of Margin Call, starring Robert Redford and with music by Alexander Ebert of Edward Sharpe and the Magnetic Zeros, in theaters now.
I'm Marty Moscoane with a message for you procrastinators. You've held out until the end of the drive is in sight. Good for you. The early birds got us off to a strong start, and now it's up to you to make sure we have a strong finish. Now it's your turn to make a pledge of support to Radio Times and WHYY to keep this radio service strong. I know you know the number. Here it is. It's 1-888-345-9499. And you can pledge online at our secure server, and I know you know that website as well. It's whyy.org. We have a goal of 60 pledges of support during this hour of the show, but you're just one of those callers, and your pledge of support makes all the difference in the world. How do you put a price tag on what you hear on Radio Times, covering regional, national, and international news, trends, and issues? And, of course, we introduce you to interesting people and ideas. Make a call. It's 1-888-345-9499, whyy.org. Thanks very much.
Supporting WHYY, the Master's Degree in Nonprofit Leadership from the University of Pennsylvania. Now accepting applications for both full and part-time admission. The Nonprofit Leadership Program at Penn. Imagine, achieve, lead. Details at npl.upenn.edu.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain. We're talking about prescription drug abuse. We're talking about heroin, the connection between the two. David Fialco, prevention specialist at the Council of Southeast Pennsylvania. And for information about his organization, their website is councilsepa.org. Also with us is Jerry Daly, executive director of the Philadelphia Camden High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area Program. And their website is PCHIDTA.org. And they also are sitting right across from me here in our Philadelphia studios. And you can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get, it looks like Kara from Bucks County to join our conversation. Kara, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm actually the adopted mother of three of my relative children. One is from, she's 2 years old now, but we've had her since she was born.
Yep.
And her mother is not the, like he's saying, what he's saying, like, how it's not what you would think. She was a married woman. She was a mother of four. She was just an excellent mother. And she ended up getting in an accident where she broke her tailbone and then was prescribed prescription drugs. And it just spiraled out of control to the point where she actually hid a pregnancy from her family. And then eventually the baby was born, and the baby was born addicted. And, of course, you know, the money that had been spent to try to pay for all these prescription drugs, because they are so expensive.
Sure.
They lost their home, her marriage, and the four older children who have had such a wonderful mother for such a long time lost their mother. Her oldest daughter at the time was 17. And at this point, she's still not in contact with the family, although she's trying to reach out and reconcile somewhat now.
Sure.
It's just really hard for everyone to accept all of the horrible things that happened because of this addiction.
Well, Kara, first of all, I appreciate the phone call, and obviously you're taking care of your niece there and being a really good sister, and I think your story really dovetails with what we've been talking about, David, which is just, for some people, this is just this spiraling down with all the implications that Kara just talked about.
Yeah, and, you know, I mentioned earlier, you know, about the critical period in the formation of the adolescent brain and how, you know, dependencies are formed during those years. Most people who are in recovery, who are dealing with addiction, picked up those behaviors and that dependency in their formative years, during their teen years. But what we're seeing now is kind of what your caller just identified, which is, you know, this person sounds like somebody who's never had a history of any type of, you know, dependency, abuse, or and, you know, they were prescribed these pills, and they're non-discriminatory. They will solicit a positive, very euphoric response to the opioid receptors in the human brain. And once the opioid receptors get a taste for these drugs, they seek it. It's something that just changes the way the brain works. So people who are wonderful mothers, wonderful fathers, you know, upstanding citizens, and whatever the case, their drive, their reward-seeking mechanisms in the brain turn to drug-seeking behaviors. Not everybody.
Of course.
You know, of course, this isn't, you know, you take this drug, you're going to end up shooting heroin. But everybody's different, and you don't know if you are bulletproof or not.
Do you see, though, this, Jerry, as a law enforcement issue? I mean, this is something very complicated. If we're talking about addictions, we're talking about people whose lives are spiraling down. Is this a responsibility of law enforcement or something larger than
well,
that?
Well, it's certainly partly our responsibility, but I think it goes far beyond the law enforcement community's ability to affect change. I mean, some of this goes to the issue of treatment and prevention that David's involved in, and identifying the evidence-based programs that actually do work in keeping people from initiating drug use, or if for one reason or another, like the caller's sister circumstance, where it's kind of an accidental addiction in some respects, how do we treat them so that effectively we can get them away from that habit? It's a very, very difficult task to do. And we're not there yet in terms of scientific research. Beyond that, we have to start looking at medical policies and practices, and what are the responsibilities of physicians and dispensers of prescription drugs to their patients to make sure that they understand, one, the properties of it, and two, that the doctor or clinician of whatever sort is monitoring that use along the way. And that's where things like prescription drug monitoring programs and such that are the topic of conversation in Harrisburg right now come into play.
Well, I mean, on the one hand, you see stigma. Of course, if there is stigma associated with heroin use or drug use. And on the other hand, this sense that I'll be okay, I can do this and I can manage it.
I got this.
And you hear that a lot. You do. You hear that a lot. It's no big deal. Those words actually come out of, youth's mouths who are dependent substance.
Let me see what it looks like. Court from South Philadelphia has to say. Court, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah. I'd like to comment about Suboxone. I mean, we have a method for normal people to lead normal lives with opiate replacement therapy. Suboxone is a partial antagonist / agonist. But the medical establishment and the harm reduction community and pharmaceutical industry will only allow certain doctors to prescribe it, and those doctors do not take insurance. And they will charge their patients up to $400 a month for this simple way of curbing addiction. And the DEA is doing little to crack down on doctors just prescribing OxyContin and Percocet, which people overdose on, but then they only allow certain doctors. I believe each doctor can only have 100 patients, and these doctors won't take insurance. There's all these stringent laws on prescribing Suboxone when no one's ever overdosed on it.
Well, you know what, Court, let me take your call and actually toss it over to you, David, just from your experience working in methadone clinics and dealing with drug abuse.
I think Suboxone is a very effective solution to a person who's seeking to recover from an opioid dependency. The standards right now require a person to be pretty stable in their recovery to where they can appropriately use it, because the thing with Suboxone is it can be used as a stay safe. If a person is in that drug-seeking stage of their addiction and they're going out engaging in activities to seek that high, Suboxone comes into play to where they can take it. And it's short acting. It will prevent them from going into withdrawal. So they can use it if they can't access their drug of choice. But the next day or later that evening, they can go out and they can use their substance of choice. Whereas methadone and other areas block the euphoric effect of the heroin or whatever opiate the person is taking. So there's good and there's but I think a person needs to be certain place in their recovery before they move to Suboxone. That's just my opinion. There's a lot. I'm not a doctor, but talking on the terms of Suboxone and other things, one of the things that the community needs to get out there, maybe even more importantly than Suboxone, is Naloxone, which is an overdose reversal drug, which saves lives. 10,000 lives were saved last year by using naloxone. EMTs have access to it. It's currently in the judiciary on the floor in the Senate. Representative Gene DiGirolamo has introduced Bill HB 1627, which is an overdose, which is a Good Samaritan law. Delaware, New Jersey, New York currently have it. We don't, which means a person can call the law enforcement EMTs and save a life without worrying about being arrested for either using or supplying a drug.
And I saw you nodding your head, Jerry.
Yeah, this past week and into the early part of this week, the International Association of Chiefs of Police were here in Philadelphia for their conference, and there were a couple of workshops relating to this. One is one, if you want to call it, test bed for using naloxone more widely is Quincy, Massachusetts. Oh. Up there, virtually all the police department now carries naloxone with them, and they've done a remarkable job in reversing overdose episodes so that they didn't have the fatalities and such. There are some issues with that. It's obviously it involves training. It involves making sure you have the correct supplies, and they're actually using a intranasal form of it, whereas right now predominantly all that's been approved by the FDA for use is intravenous injections of it. So, you know, there's some regulatory things there. But naloxone is very promising for reversing it. But that's first aid. That's like a epi stick for a bee sting type
exactly.
thing for a person with an allergy. It's not treatment for the problem. And that's really where it's at.
And we're talking with David Fiacco and Jeremiah Daly. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me actually get some more callers. And we have, it looks like Michael from South Jersey waiting to join our conversation. Michael, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm a surgical resident for a hospital, and I think one of the things that is interesting to me is that every hour on the hour, the nurse goes into the patient's room and assesses their pain level. A lot of these people aren't necessarily in a lot of pain, but they're bored, and whereas they may be able to take Tylenol or an NSAID, such as ibuprofen or what have you, they're offered painlessness. And I'm not sure, I haven't looked into why we've been taught to do this, but we're taught in medical school and in the beginning parts of our residencies that people shouldn't have to suffer. And I think you made the point earlier in the show that it used to be that people did fine with a little bit of Tylenol or a bear or what have you, and doctors, and I'm not sure if it's because of litigation or what, but we've been taught to take the pain away, and that's only really possible through some fairly powerful drugs. And I know for myself, I would rather give morphine than Dilaudid. Mm. I'd rather give ibuprofen than morphine.
Well,
I'd rather give Tylenol.
Well, you know what, Michael?
Let me
take your point, because I think it really underscores some of what we've been talking about before. In fact, David, you talked quite a bit about that. Just that, I mean, no one wants to be in pain. We have to be obvious about that. But, what is pain? What is discomfort? Interesting to think about.
Absolutely. And I think that, any prescription medication comes with a risk. So you always have to look at the risk-benefit factor. You have to look at the benefit of taking this drug and the possible risks or outcomes associated with taking this drug. And I think that for many, many, many office visits, I mentioned the number of office scripts that are written, how many of those would aspirin, NSAIDs be acceptable? I'm not a doctor, so I don't want to, go too far, but I think that we are an overprescribing society currently. That's just my opinion.
And I think another point that it needs to be – we certainly don't want to go back to the days when you put a stick between the person's
teeth. Well, of course.
Surgery.
Right.
We don't want to go there. But we also have made some flubs along the way too with medication. Heroin itself was first synthesized by Bayer. The aspirin company.
Bayer aspirin.
It was used as as an anesthetic in the battlefields of World War I, and that was the best option available at the time. We've obviously progressed a long way since then. I think that's one of the things that we have to do now, too, is recognize that there has to be continued progress in identifying better pain management techniques and therapeutic processes than what we have now. That's one of the ways out of this jam. The other part, to go back to your point about, you know, the what role law enforcement has in
sure.
this, you know, we don't want to, and we are not going to arrest our way out of, you know, these kind of problems. But our domestic and international efforts have to be, you know, focused on identifying where the sources of the illicit street drugs, the heroines and such, are coming from, and really, you know, bearing down on that at the organizations and cartels that are moving
the sources, and they might be in other countries or
and
the dealer on the street.
Exactly.
And since we began by talking about suburban youth and youth that are getting themselves all mm-hmm. tangled up in this, in the minute or two that we have left here, what advice do you have for school officials,
parents, adults, recognize the problem. We have some great schools all throughout Bucks County that are addressing this issue. They're having be part of the conversations. There's schools that are identifying that this is a problem in our school. Education, prevention, raise awareness. My employer, we have what's called an overdose advisory board, prevention and education overdose advisory board. We're available to come out and provide trainings on this topic so that parents, grassroots coalitions, professionals know more about this issue. You can follow that up with our website. But education, I think, is the key point here. If you don't think it's in your schools, if you don't think it's in your neighborhood, you are sadly mistaken. You're absolutely. It's there. When one out of four kids report using a prescription medication in the last 30 days.
That's a lot.
That's a lot.
Well, and just this little note that there is, I guess this weekend around the region, that people can drop off their extra prescription drugs.
Around the region, around the country, is the DEA-sponsored Take Back Day, where all prescription drugs, not necessarily, you know, opiates, but any kind of prescription drug can be brought back. DEA.gov. There's a search tool on there by zip code. You can find the closest places to make a drop-off. Here in Philadelphia, it's mostly our firehouses.
There you go. And I know some police departments around the area as well, also taking people's extra prescriptions. Well, Jerry Daly, thank you very much for joining us today on
My
Radio
pleasure.
Times. And David Fialco, thank you very much as well.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. And we appreciate those phone calls to Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. Do stay with us for Hour 2. We'll be right back.